Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up, a special Christmas Day edition of our program with some of our favorite conversations with writers from the past year.
Harvard historian Jill Lepore tells the story of the little-known life of Benjamin Franklin's favorite sister, Jane.
Their attachment as children displays itself over the course of their lives. Franklin writes more letters to Jane than he writes to anyone else.
And former CIA spy Valerie Plame on what inspired her to write her new thriller, Blowback.
To try to paint a portrait of a female operations officer who isn't just using sex and guns, although they're great too.
Plus, André Dubuis III on love, sex, and betrayal, and what he's finally learned about life.
I'm in my 50s now, and I've finally come to the conclusion as to why we're on the planet. You want to hear the secret?
Yes.
Okay.
All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston.
First, this news. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks, and we hope you're having a wonderful Christmas Day. We're going to spend the next hour reprising some of our favorite conversations with writers from the past year.
We'll begin with Jill Lepore, a history professor at Harvard University and a staff writer for The New Yorker, who brought us the story of a woman named Jane and her brother Benjamin. When they were young, they were called Jenny and Benny.
They were very close. Benny once wrote, "The two eyes of a man do not more resemble, nor are capable of being upon better terms with each other, than my sister and myself."
Jenny agreed. "We had seldom any contention among us," she wrote. "All was harmony."
They loved each other dearly. They teased each other. In response to Jenny's claim that all was harmony, Benny wrote, "I think our family were always subject to being a little miffy."
"You introduce your reproof of my miffy temper so politely," she joked back. "One can't avoid wishing to have conquered it as you have."
However, their letters also reveal that Jenny spelled poorly. She never learned how to hold a pen properly. Jenny married at 15, had 12 children, only one of whom survived her.
Her brother, however, became one of the founding fathers of the United States.
Benny's full name was Benjamin Franklin. Jenny was his sister, Jane Franklin Meekum, his most beloved sibling, yet someone he never once mentions in his own memoirs.
If Ben Franklin was the self-styled everyman of the Revolution, historian Jill Lepore writes that Jane was everyone else. She tells Jane's little-known life story in Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. And when we spoke to Lepore back in October, she began by reading a passage from one of the few surviving letters written by Jane Franklin in her own hand. It's dated 1758, when Franklin was 45 years old.
"Dear sister, for so I must call you, come what will, and if I don't express myself proper, you must excuse it, seeing I have not been accustomed to pay my compliments to governor and baronet's ladies. I am in the midst of a great wash, and Sarah is still sick, and I would gladly have been excused writing this post, but my husband says I must write and give you joy, which we sincerely join in. I suppose it will not be news to you, but I will tell you how I came by it. Mr. Flucker told Cousin Williams, and he, Dr. Perkins, who brought it to my poor son Nettie, who has had another relapse into raising blood, and has not done one stroke of work this month, but was just going to begin when he was taken ill. Pray pardon my bad writing and confused composure, and accept it as coming from your ladyship's affectionate sister and most obedient, humble servant, Jane Meekum."
Now, first of all, we have to say that that letter, even though it's from Jane Franklin and intended for her brother Benjamin Franklin, she didn't write that one in particular directly to Ben Franklin.
Right. This is to his wife. She knows he's going to read it, but this is to his wife, Deborah.
And this was because she had found out through the grapevine, essentially, as she describes, that there was a rumor that Ben Franklin had been given a title of some kind.
Yeah, that he'd been named a baron. And so it's a very miffy, she was a very miffy person. And so was Franklin. Franklin just had other guises for his miffiness. But so, you know, this is very frank. She has this quite conversational writing style. She really wrote exactly the way she spoke. She was uneducated, so she didn't know how to do anything else except to write down what she would say if someone were sitting right next to her. So it's like, you know, it's just full of jabs. You know, how can you possibly be a baron, first of all? But second of all, if you were, why am I the last person to know about it?
Yeah, and by the way, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge from your humble servant and all that stuff. So, I mean, you get a sense as to the voice of who this woman was. was when she was 45. And I'm going to talk to you, I want to talk to you in a little bit about just that fact that of the many, many letters she wrote, we have to wait until she's 45 in our present day to, you know, to see these letters, because not many or zero of them before 1758 actually do exist. But let's even move further back in time, though, and talk about the childhood of Benjamin Franklin and Jane Franklin. Ben Franklin was the youngest son, but Jane was the youngest of the Franklin children. What was their relationship like as children?
Well, so there's 10 boys and 7 girls, and their father is a poor candle maker and soap boiler in Boston, and they're the closest of all the Franklin children. They were called Benny and Jenny. Everybody in their family thought of them as the two that were most alike. I think that their attachment as children displays itself over the course of their lives. Franklin writes more letters to Jane than he writes to anyone else. Their correspondence, you know, begins the day he turns 21. He runs away when he's 17, and the first letter he writes home is to Jane on his 21st birthday. And
their correspondence continues for over 60 years.
Yeah, for over 60 years. And, you know, it's full of expressions of affection. And Franklin doesn't have that run of correspondence with anyone else in his family. The two of them live longer than anyone else who's left, for one thing. But they often recall how special they are to one another. The way that people talk about them, too, like Franklin, you know, we know a lot about who Franklin was, right? He talks about himself. He's very saucy and he was very rebellious. And he wants to describe his personality as that of, like, the allegorical American. Like, he won't stand for tyranny, and he'll always fight the good fight, and he knows it's important to do good, and he will not accept arbitrary power. But Jane is actually the same, is in sort of the same way. So there's a lot of elements of their personality that are quite similar.
So very much alike in temperament, but, you know, by virtue of one being a boy and the other being a girl, almost nothing like each other in terms of the, you know, their earliest access to education.
Yeah, no, their lives couldn't have been more different. It's interesting because there's this classic, like, a lot of Enlightenment thought experiments work this way. What if there was a boy and a girl and they were born at the same time, they were twins, and they entered society and were raised as a boy and a girl would be, but they were born with the same natural genius, as we would say in the 18th century. How would their lives transpire? Well, this isn't a thought experiment. This is actually, you can watch how this happens. I mean, Franklin is born in 1706. Jane is born in 1712, and they live, you know, into the 1790s. So you can watch sort of the 18th century evolve. But what the 18th century meant for boys and girls and the different ways that they were supported and their education was supported, boys learned how to read and write, and girls only learned how to read.
Right. And, I mean, in fact, you point out that at the time of Jane Franklin's birth in the colonies, only, what, 2 out of 5 women even knew how to sign their names.
Yeah. And that's really, for those who could do that, that's really usually all they knew how to do.
Wow. You know, you point out that for any additional education in the letters and writing that Jane Franklin may have received in those early years of her life, it was because Ben Franklin taught her.
Yeah, I really do think that. I mean, their correspondence has that feel, right? She's always apologizing for specific errors that she's made, and he'll correct her. Franklin believed passionately in education. He's this young man who's fascinated by this, among many other questions, right? But should girls be educated? I think that's because of Jane.
Yeah.
We carry around in our heads, so many of us, I think, a notion that the only people who lived in the 18th century were like Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, George Washington, and John Hancock or something. But really, that's just not the case. I mean, Jane is a really good proxy for most ordinary people's experience, not just for women, but for many men who were very poorly educated too, of course. But it's really interesting, I think, to juxtapose the two of them because we see so much more.
Mm. Well, but particularly with Jane, I would say that she does give voice to the experience of women at that time because, you know, while her beloved brother Benjamin runs away and ends up being a man of the world and, you know, a leading light of the American Revolution, she got married at the age of 15.
Yeah, which, you know, was illegal at the time. She's pregnant or nursing for the next, you know, 24 years straight. So when Franklin runs away and, you know, opens up a printing shop and then opens a library in Philadelphia, and he says how he devotes an hour or two each day to reading in his library to make up for the loss of his education because he was too poor to go to Harvard, this the woman with 12 children who's also taking care of her elderly parents is not devoting 2 hours each day to reading. It's just, it's not physically possible. Like, it's hard to imagine how anyone could have gotten really very much sleep under such circumstances.
Yeah. Now, Jill Lepore, there are a fraction of the number of letters that Jane Franklin actually wrote to her brother Benjamin that exist. But the title of your book, Book of Ages, comes from a thing that she herself, Jane Franklin, created and called the Book of Ages. So first of all, describe it. What is it?
Yeah, it's this tiny little pamphlet. I mean, picture something, you know, it's sort of as rough as burlap. I mean, it's a homemade paper she made herself. She took four sheets of foolscap and folded them and stitched them together with some thread. So it's this little tiny book of 16 pages. It's here in an archive in Boston. It's amazing that it was saved. And on the front page, she's written in this really lavish hand, just these three words, Book of Ages. You know, you open the page and it says Jane Franklin, born March 27th, 1712. And I think, oh, it's going to be an autobiography, like Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. She's going to tell the story of our life, and it's going to be this amazing thing because there is no other similar document for such a, you know, poor, ordinary woman. But it's not the story of her life, or it's the story of her life as she understood what story needed telling. It's a chronicle of the births and deaths of her children.
It's so tragic. And to me, as when, I mean, there's a page in your book under the chapter titled Black Day when Jane is 52 years old. And in the course of this year, she writes, you know, June the 12th, 1764, died a beloved and deservedly lamented daughter, Sarah Flagg. November 9th, 1764, died under my care, my daughter Flagg's youngest child, age 17 months. Then March 1765, died my daughter Flagg's second daughter. I mean, it just goes on and on, this chronicle of all these her children and grandchildren that she's outliving.
Yeah. I mean, most of her children grow to adulthood and have children of their own, and then the daughters all die in childbirth, and then the sons, two of them go mad, and the others seem to die of tuberculosis. So she writes to Franklin, you know, sorrows roll upon me like the waves upon the sea. It's not that unusual of an experience in the 18th century. What's unusual is that she has the capacity to write it down. I mean, think about the consequences of all those women not being able to write. There's their domestic sorrows. They can't chronicle them. They're, you know, ministers in Boston, Puritan ministers, tell people, do not get lost in grief, bound your sorrow, weep not. There are all kinds of prohibitions on expressing your grief. Jane's completely defying them, even by in some ways, by writing this chronicle. And when she's really felled by grief, not long after the passage that you just mentioned there in 1767, she just stops writing down because she writes, you know, Lord, may I never be so rebellious as to question, you know, Providence, because she's begun to question Providence. By the 1760s, with all the ferment going on with the American Revolution, she's begun to think, maybe all these deaths, maybe this just isn't fair and fated to me, to befall me.
But Benjamin Franklin, one of his most famous works, if not the most famous, is his own autobiography, right? And it's the story of him. But why is it that he never mentions her, even though she's the most important member of his family, to him, in his autobiography?
Yeah, well, Franklin is a wily, sneaky guy. I love Franklin. I find him hilarious and charming, and he's brilliant, and I enjoy his company immensely. But, I mean, the whole point, he writes that autobiography it's meant to be useful. It's meant to be a guide to young tradesmen, how to sort of rise out of the trades to become a gentleman. It really is, like every other piece of advice he ever wrote in Poor Richard's Proverb, or Advice to a Young Tradesman, or The Way to Wealth, industry begets riches, you know. And so, no, the women who take care of you and do your laundry do not beget riches. You have to do it all yourself. Like, it's really, for that narrative to work. It's a myth. He knows it's a myth,
right,
it's a myth, and it can't really be about his sister and, you know, the people he left behind and people whose industry did not yield riches. That's not the story he wants to tell. That's not the myth he wants to create.
Why do you think that Benjamin Franklin, through this whole, you know, 60-plus, period of 60-plus years, maintained the correspondence with her?
You know, I think for a couple of reasons. One, I think he does quite adore her. And I think he also feels bad about leaving her. Her fate was different than anyone else in the family. And I think if he'd stayed, she wouldn't have married at 15, and he knows that. She's also his only anchor to his past. I mean, when he comes to Boston, which is only every 10 years, he stays with her. She's the person that attaches him to his roots. He also kind of needs that cred. Like when he's in Paris, you know, swanning around and is pretending to be like a country bumpkin because that gets him a lot of clout at like dinner parties. He has her send some of the family soap, like, please make me some soap and please don't make it especially fine. Like, make me the crumbly greenish kind. And then he gives it away to all the courtiers in Paris to sort of, yes, this is where I come from. Like, this, my sister still makes soap. Like, this gives him all kinds of cred as a man who has made this rise. Like, if your whole story of your life is a rags to riches rise, you need someone who's still in rags to be your anchor.
So what's so interesting to me, Jill Lepore, is that the very thing that draws us and you to the story of Jane Franklin is a thing that must have made her so hard to write about, is that hers is a voice that's not often heard, even less documented in history. We actually have not that much of her writing. I mean, was it, you've said, you wrote in The New Yorker that it was, writing about her was like trying to paint a phantom.
Yeah, it was a really hard project to do. It's hard to commit to. And I always thank my mother for pushing me to finish it, because she really cared about the story. You know, it felt to me like it's so easy to just look at what I consider the asymmetry of evidence. Like, we knew so much more about men like Benjamin Franklin than we do about, you know, ordinary housewives, widows, whatever, or mothers like Jane Franklin. I got really kind of fascinated with the idea, you know, Franklin invented bifocals, you know, so that you could look at things in the distance and up close with the same set of glasses, just, you know, have two lenses in your same frame. Mm-hmm. And I think that historians really ought to work that way. Like, we can't understand Benjamin Franklin without thinking about Jane. Look, she's his most important correspondent. Like, how could we understand him without her? And we can't understand her without him.
Jill Lepore's new book is Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, former CIA spy Valerie Plame talks about her new career in fiction. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're listening back today to some of our favorite conversations with writers from the past year. Next, we'll hear from Valerie Plame, who many people know not for her writing, but for her former occupation as a CIA spy.
Until 2003, when members of the Bush administration blew her cover. Now she writes novels about spies, the CIA, the intelligence business. And it is fiction of a sort. In Plame's new thriller, the heroine is a sexy blonde CIA spy named Vanessa Pearson, the same initials as the author. And like Plame, Vanessa Pearson is trying to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. She tracks a rogue nuclear arms dealer in a tense manhunt that shifts from Washington to Europe to the Near East while juggling a forbidden romance with a fellow ops officer.
Valerie Plame's new novel, co-written by Sarah Lovett, is called Blowback. She joined us back in October, and we began by asking her about crafting her female protagonist.
Well, the genesis came out of my own deeply held frustration of how females are portrayed in the espionage genre. They tend to be such paper dolls. They're really cardboard characters, and I wanted to show someone that used their mind a lot more than guns, and because that's really how human intelligence is collected.
Well, the best advice that I think a writer can get is to write what you know, and you've certainly done that. So is this fiction? How much is Valerie Plame, Vanessa Pearson?
It is fiction, but it's obviously informed by my experiences with the CIA.
Yeah.
It opens, you know, the plot wraps around a secret Iranian nuclear facility, which, as we speak, in Geneva, the very high-level talks going on between the United States and Iran on that very issue. And it's something that was my expertise in the CIA, nuclear counterproliferation. So it was... It's important to me then, important to me now, and it was easy to start the story off with that.
Mm. I want to ask you about the book, but I'm also interested in what you view out there in the real world. And speaking of Iran, what's your take on the new Iranian president, Rouhani? Mm-hmm. What it looks like a thaw in U.S.-Iran relations. What do you make of it?
I am heartened that they are actually sitting down. This is the first time since the revolution, over 30 years, that talks have taken place at this level. So I'm always encouraged by that, because military action against Iran would be catastrophic for everyone concerned, for sure. I have to believe that, you know, the United States is a great country, and we should be speaking to our friends as well as our enemies. We have diplomatic relations, not as a favor to be passed out like ice cream cones, but because it's in our own national security interest. So it's clear that Iran definitely wants to rejoin the community of nations, and that they want that the Islamic Iranian Republic is not going away, but they realize that they need to maybe find a way forward. So I, like President Reagan said, you need to trust but verify, but it's a good start.
So as somebody who's tracked those issues around nuclear proliferation, I mean, how do you judge claims by Iran that that their nuclear program is there for peaceful, peaceful purposes only.
Well, in part, that's what my old outfit did. I mean, that's what the importance of intelligence. It runs parallel and it should complement diplomatic overtures and channels. But intelligence tells you of different sorts, whether it's human intelligence, electronic intelligence, overhead satellite, all of that. It helps you with your calculations. What are their intents? What is their saying is sort of close to the truth? How far can you push? It is clear that Iran has been seeking a nuclear weapon. I mean, I really don't take them to be truthful when they say they're just pursuing this for energy needs. And let's face it, they are in a really tough neighborhood. But these sanctions have really taken a bite. So they are Rouhani, clearly, is taking a different tack. This is the guy who tweeted, "Happy Rosh Hashanah to my Jewish friends," you know. And so you know that it's quite a different bird than what we had with Ahmadinejad.
So let me come back to sort of how some of what this book portrays about what it's like to really being a spy. You know, I was raised on James Bond movies, sort of dashing, globetrotting men who knew how to mix a martini and had beautiful women on each arm. But I'm gathering the truth out there. It's a lot more mundane.
Vanessa Pearson has beautiful men on each arm.
Well, that's true. But there is that. But you also make the point that it's a little more mundane, right? The actual intelligence work.
Well, it can be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of waiting time. But I tried very hard to get all the spy craft right.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of an eye-rolling moment for me in most either TV or movie depictions of the CIA. They get that all wrong.
What's your pet peeve? What do they usually get wrong?
Well, here's one. Yeah. You don't use cell phones in CIA headquarters, okay? They are transmission devices and tracking devices and do so much more than make a... So that's one thing. But how people move in and out of countries, how you communicate clandestinely, all the locations in the books are in Blowback are places that I have lived or worked or traveled, so I know them. Her relationships with her colleagues in the CIA, as well as the love affair she has with a colleague, all of those, you know, I try to be realistic and still entertaining.
Well, speaking of this love affair that is portrayed in Blowback, your character has to struggle with a little bit of life-work balance, I guess. Is that something you grappled with?
I think everyone does. Yeah. I mean, even men, right? More and more of how to get that right. As a working mother now, it's fair to say that you try to bring your A game to everything, and somehow you always feel you fall a little bit short on whichever front it might be. But she does have this relationship. The reason that it is forbidden is because he's an inside officer. He is under U.S. government cover. She is not. She has a business cover. And for obvious reasons, they should not be together because it would be compromising. But they met at the farm and sparks flew. So, you know, she's juggling that. She's trying to figure out how to maintain some semblance of normal life while also going after someone that she just thinks of as the ghost, who's the black market, nuclear black market.
Boot.
Who was inspired by the Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan.
Uh-huh. Now, as we mentioned, and as most of our listeners would know, you were outed as a CIA operative by members of the Bush administration. Do you miss being in the field?
I do. I mean, I miss my career. I loved my job. I was really proud to serve my country. If none of this had happened, I would be overseas now making my modest government salary and doing something that I thought was really worthwhile, going after the nuclear proliferation. But it didn't turn out that way. So I've had to figure out next steps.
Do you remain, or to what extent do you remain, bitter, angry at the folks in this government who outed you and ended your career?
Well, I think it's fair to say that anyone that was involved in the betrayal of my covert CIA identity is no longer in this administration, but yet they are still out there. Now, you know, neither my husband or I spent any time being bitter because it's just so useless. But we follow what's happening, you know, very carefully, and the increasing polarization and the increasing radicalism, really. And watching it all very carefully.
Oh, Valerie Plame, if that really is your name.
That's former CIA spy Valerie Plame talking to us back in October about her new novel, Blowback, co-written with Sarah Lovett.
So they made a wreck of.
And now, from a covert spy who was outed to an author forced into hiding.
Salman Rushdie is an international best-selling author of several novels, including Midnight's Children, The Moor's Last Sigh, and, of course, The Satanic Verses. And it's because of that last book that on Valentine's Day 1989, the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran issued a fatwa on Rushdie's life, declaring, "I ask all the Muslims to execute him wherever they find him."
Rushdie writes about his years in hiding in his memoir, Joseph Anton, which is out in paperback now. In October, he delivered the keynote address at the Boston Book Festival, and just before he did, he stopped by our studios. Rushdie began by reading a passage from the memoir in which he describes his early days in hiding at a friend's cottage in Wales.
As for him, he could not be seen at the farm, or its safety would be compromised. There was a farmer who looked after the sheep for Michael and Deb, and at one point he came down off the hill to talk to Michael about something. An ordinary moment became a crisis when invisibility was deemed essential. "You'd better get out of sight," Michael told him, and he had to duck down behind a kitchen counter. As he crouched there, listening to Michael get rid of his man as quickly as possible, he felt a sense of deep shame. To hide in this way was to be stripped of all self-respect. To be told to hide was a humiliation. Maybe, he thought, to live like this would be worse than death. In his novel, Shame, he had written about the workings of Muslim honor culture, at the poles of whose moral axis were honor and shame very different from the Christian narrative of guilt and redemption. He came from that culture, even though he was not religious, and had been raised to care deeply about questions of pride. To skulk and hide was to lead a dishonorable life. He felt very often in those years profoundly ashamed, both shamed and ashamed.
That's Salman Rushdie reading a passage from Joseph Anton, his memoir. Now, Mr. Rushdie, I have to say that that is the passage that really stayed with me, because the image of you cowering, basically, behind the counter in your friend's cottage was just so shocking. But I wonder, why is it that you write that you felt ashamed in those early days?
Well, because there's nothing at all dignified about it. You know, it feels cowardly, feels running away from something, feels unmanly. It has all kinds of very strong, you know, emotional triggers. And I hated doing it. This was, remember, at the very, very beginning of all this, when the temperature was very, very high, and this was headline news on every television and radio station.
I mean, you had become one of the most famous men in the world overnight because of it.
In those early days, we really had no idea what was coming at us. You know, there was no way of knowing how big the attack would be and how big the danger was to people. And so I had to call friends, and people had to go and rent cottages for me and so on. So there was a... I mean, I don't think I was anywhere for more than... I mean, the longest I was somewhere was for a couple of weeks at that time.
You know, in the book you write about how, in reality, there's no such thing as an ordinary life. And you quote, or you mention that how surrealists say that our ability to experience the world is dulled by habituation. Mm. But I wonder, with the tumult and the uncertainty and the fear in those early weeks and months after the fatwa had been imposed upon you, you must have yearned for that habituation.
I mean, very much so. And it's one of the strange things about the kind of the other end of the story is that when I actually, you know, when I was released from the clutches of the police web, you know, and allowed to regain an ordinary life, you know, you might have thought that after a decade of being denied it, it would be quite difficult, you know, to adjust back. But actually, I mean, I surprised myself that I adjusted back like within a day. Within a day, I was hailing taxis and going to the supermarket and, you know, behaving like it never happened. And what it taught me was really that our desire for ordinary life is so deep, you know, the denial of it is such a trauma that when we're given it back, we just grab it, you know, as something very precious.
Ferociously, in fact. You were given security, a protection detail for just about all of the time that you had to be in hiding. And I wonder if you could describe, I mean, there's this question of ordinariness, but also dignity and indignity and some of the ordinary things that you had to negotiate with your security team in order to feel like you were living a dignified life.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing was that everybody who receives this kind of protection finds the intrusion into their private life very difficult.
Right.
You know, I mean, I talked to Tony Blair about it once, and when he became prime minister, he had small children. And it was very difficult just doing what you have to do with your children, like getting them to school and so on.
Right. Well, you had children, too, and you weren't even able to see them.
Well, you know, it was one of the things we had to do was at least create the illusion that I wasn't able to see my son, you know, because we didn't want to bring the danger in that direction. So there was a kind of public fiction that I couldn't see him, and behind that public fiction, I occasionally could see him. Right. But it was very difficult. It required all kinds of, you know, shenanigans.
So much to talk about with you, Salman Rushdie, but there's a couple other things about those early days of your life in hiding that I would just love to dig into a little bit more. And one of them is that, you know, we were talking about your son. You had promised him that you were going to publish a book. And you did, in 1990?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
a children's book
called Harun and the Sea of Stories. And I was just looking back at the beginning of it, and I saw a line in it that said, describing a city that plays a central role in the book, and you write that it's a sad city, the saddest of cities, a city so ruinously sad it had forgotten its name.
Mm.
And did you write this while you were in hiding?
Yes, I did. It was my way back to writing, really.
I mean, was that you basically describing in part your experience?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it starts from a sad place and it ends in a happy place because it's a children's book. You know, it actually has a fully fledged happy ending, which is the first time I was ever able to come up with one of those. And I guess happy endings had become important to me at the time, you know. But it's true that, I mean, I felt that there were so many ordinary life things that I couldn't do with my son at that time, that this promise that I'd made to write a book that he would enjoy, that was one I'd better keep. And I'm glad in a way that that existed, because it gave me the motivation and incentive to go back to my job, you know, and to, in a way, to rediscover my love of my job, you know, because that had been very shaken by what happened.
Right. And this idea of a city being ruinously sad and having forgotten its name, because, I mean, you had been disconnected from your normal life.
And
you
had my name.
And your name, exactly. Yeah, I mean, Joseph Anton is the pseudonym that you were asked to create.
Yeah, so that we could rent houses in it and I could write checks in it. And even more than that, that the police could train themselves, the protection teams could train themselves not to accidentally use my real name when they were in the neighborhood of where I was staying. And so if somebody overheard my name, they could work out where I was. Mm-hmm. So they had to train themselves to use this pseudonym. But I always detested having to do it and was deeply relieved when the day came that I didn't have to. And I thought the reason for making it the title of the book is just to say to people, imagine how odd it is. Imagine how bizarre it would be to live in a world in which you had to give up your name.
Right. Well, speaking of bizarre, there are aspects of this story which are both I keep calling it a story, but it is your life, which are both sort of farcical and fury-inducing. Because, you know, while all this is happening to you, especially in the first weeks and months, I mean, you write about how, for example, the Archbishop of Canterbury said he, quote, understood Muslims' feelings. And the British Foreign Secretary at the time, Geoffrey Howe, said that the book, The Satanic Verses, had been rude to Britain. And that it was the Ayatollah's government that had cut off relations with the UK, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. I wonder how that changed your view of the country you'd made your home at that time.
But it wasn't just the country. It was a kind of religious gang, you know. So if you were to look at the religious leaders, not just in England, you know, I mean, yes, in England there was this unfortunate remark by the Archbishop of Canterbury, but also by the chief rabbi of Britain. Meanwhile, something very similar was being said by the Cardinal of New York, you know, by Jimmy Carter, you know, by people around the world. And you began to realize that this group of people who all believe in different religions, you know, when a religion says it's under attack, they all join up on that team.
And the God Squad, as
the God Squad. I'm afraid it really exists, and it made me feel even more contemptuous of it than I did before.
Yeah. You know, the full fatwa that the Ayatollah had declared said that the satanic verses is against Islam, and all those involved in its publication, yes, who were or aware of its content, are sentenced to death. And in fact, your Japanese editor had been murdered.
Translator
had been murdered. Yeah. And other translators had been attacked.
No, I mean, you know, the fact is that all those included publishers, translators, booksellers, you know, and there were attacks on all of those. You know, there were pipe bombs and fire bombs in bookstores in this country and in many other countries.
And riots in several other countries.
Yeah, the Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was murdered at his university when he was working late one night. And the Italian translator, Ettore Capriolo, was left for dead after an attack and fortunately survived. And my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot 3 times in the back and miraculously made a full recovery, but you know, wasn't expected to. So this was a really serious global attack. And in many ways, I was the best protected person of all those who were vulnerable.
Do you ever feel a sense of vulnerability now?
You don't look that dangerous to me.
You don't see what I've got under the table here, no. Well, I'm glad you feel safe in this studio. But, I mean, do you?
No, not really. Not really. I mean, it's been over, you know, as you've seen, the sort of very end moment of this was almost 12 years ago. And, you know, we live in an age in which the subject changes very fast, you know, and this is such an old subject that now people have many other things to be agitated about.
Perhaps by a certain degree, but you know, you've also written that works of art, even works of entertainment, do not come into being in a social and political vacuum, mm-hmm. right? And that the way they operate in society cannot be separated from politics, from history,
yep.
for every text a context, right? That's from you. You wrote that back in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Others might say that, you know, that in fact what you experienced in 89 and the following 12 years is now sort of writ large
the world. I mean, I tried to say to the book myself, because I do believe that what happened to me and to the other people attacked was a sort of prologue, you know, that it was like the first very visible stirring of the phenomenon of Islamic fanaticism, which later, of course, exploded onto a much, much bigger stage, you know, and I think you can show a series of steps, you know, which lead from not just the attack on my book, because there were attacks on other books in the Muslim world at that same time, but how it began with attacks on writers and intellectuals and how it broadened to be a much broader attack.
Well, we have about 30 seconds left, but those steps continue. So when you see perhaps what looks as if a thawing between U.S. and Iran right now, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, you know, keep your fingers crossed and don't hold your breath.
Well, Salman Rushdie is author of Joseph Anton, a memoir. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a lesson in love from the Newburyport-based writer Andre Debuse III. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're listening back to some of our favorite authors that we featured on Radio Boston this past year.
In 1960, the Everly Brothers recorded a song called Love Hurts. And as many of us know, it can and often does. That idea is certainly at the heart of Dirty Love, a new book from author Andre Debuse III. Dirty Love is a collection of 4 novellas about the dark side, the complicated side, the painful side of love. They're stories about need, control, betrayal, and sex, but also about hope, maybe even about redemption. They're also stories about people who seem touchingly real. Andre Debuse lives in Newburyport. He's the author of House of Sand and Fog and his memoir, Townie. His new book is Dirty Love. And Andre, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me, Anthony. It's great to be here.
And congratulations on this beautiful book.
Thank you. Tell me
briefly what links these 4 novellas.
Oh, desire, loss, hope, weakness. You know, here I'm in my 50s now, and I've finally come to the conclusion as to why we're on the planet. You want to hear the secret?
Yes.
Okay. I just think we're here for one reason. Well, 2 reasons, but the main reason I think we're here is to is to learn how to love and be loved. I think that's it. And it ain't easy.
It ain't easy. Well, these stories bring that out so touchingly. What I love, always love about your writing is you write about people who are flawed, but they're so touchingly believable and human. And I find myself liking a lot of what they do, but then understanding why they do it.
Good.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. Well, it sort of reflects my view. You know, I mean, you know, I hear that a lot, you know, that my characters are flawed, but I don't know a human being who's not. I sure as hell am flawed. And I'm just trying to capture these people as fully as I possibly can. And I think if a writer does that, the people will start to feel real. And what's real are what's not right about us, not what's right about us. I mean, we all go to our jobs. We brush our teeth and pay our taxes and, you know, iron our clothes, and we all come across like we've got it all together, but I think we're really kind of all a mess. And I think it's okay to be a bit of a mess. I really do.
I want to talk about a couple of the stories. The first one is called Listen Carefully as Our Options Have Changed. It tells the story of Mark. He's a tech company project manager who discovers that his beautiful wife of 25 years is having an affair. And as I read it, I found myself sympathizing with him, sort of for obvious reasons, but then slowly you learn why the marriage foundered. You begin to understand what happened to his wife, why she went the route she went. So tell us a little bit about Mark.
Mark is sort of modeled after about four of my friends' marriages that have ended in divorce, and the symptom that's triggered the divorce has been infidelity, which is really interesting to me. I don't think the other woman or the other man is the cause of the problem. It's a symptom.
Yeah.
So with Mark, I was really drawn to trying to enter into the psyche of a man who, on the surface, really had it together. You know, upper middle class, drives a BMW sedan, is a very successful project manager, wears a Movado wristwatch, wears Tommy Bahama silk shirts, has a pool, a lovely wife who's miserable. So I was sort of siding with him, sympathizing with his pain as he wakes up on his mother's couch in the in-law apartment while his wife's got the house next to him, and she's still cheating on him. But we discover that it's not so simple, and loving him and being loved by him wasn't so great for her either. And you know what, too, I discovered in that story is he's a project manager, and you know, I really do think that we bring our jobs home with us, and they really mold us. I know when I used to work construction, I would come home, I really was so physically exhausted, and the engineering side of my brain was so exhausted. All I wanted was a beer. I wanted to grunt and put on the remote. I mean, and then when coming back from teaching, I'm talkative and I'm inspired, and I'm a different guy when I'm coming back from that. So if nothing else, I think that Mark's job really sort of shaped how he was at home and how he treated his human relationships. And while it was successful at work, it wasn't the successful way to be a partner with a grown woman.
It seems like it also reminds us of what we see on the surface of relationships, whether it's infidelity or other problems, that people's actions within relationships are only part of the truth about what's really going on.
Yeah, isn't that true? Yeah. You know, an actor friend of mine went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and he did a performance in the master actor pulled him aside and said, "You know, Paul, that was a good performance, but it wasn't a great one." And then Paul said, "Well, why? I gave it everything I had." He said, "Well, I don't know what to tell you, buddy, except none of us are just one note. We are all a symphony." And to me, I love that line because it speaks to the multitudes that we all are at all times. And, you know, I think if I preach nothing else in my writing classes and when I give talks and et cetera, is that what might distinguish good writing from very good writing is you can sense whether the writer is really curious enough about the characters. I really think we have to be really curious about these people. Otherwise, we will perhaps judge them and typify them, and then they're not as real as they need to be.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of my favorite lines from all time is a Tom Waits song, and the line is, "There ain't no devil, there's just God when he's drunk." and it's frankly my theology. I just believe we're all, I've never met a bad baby. We're all born full of light and love and needing to be loved. And then the rest of our lives are screwing it up and trying to get back where we've started.
Well, sticking with this first story, I love the way it ends because it left me wondering what Mark learns in the end. And I wanted to get you to read just a bit. This is the end of the story, starting in the middle of page 80 there.
He would apologize. And they would talk not about what had happened, only what had to happen next. Maybe they would reach over and touch. Maybe they would even kiss. Maybe Laura would stand and walk away as she had every right to do. Or she would softly squeeze his fingers and lead him back into their house and up to their room and into their bed, and they would make love, no matter what each of them had done earlier or with whom. And it would be different this time. He would pay more attention, and he would let her do whatever she wanted. Then and later, every day and every night and week and month, she chose to stay with him, which she might not. This woman whose footsteps he now heard through the door, his heart in his head once again, for he did not know if he was even up for any of this, this change from change, the door swinging inward as he straightened, his wife's face lovely and surprised and waiting.
Is he redeemed? Has he figured it out? Is it going to be okay? Or is he, like, dreaming and sort of, you lost your chance with this one, buddy?
Well, a woman friend of mine read it and said, oh, he's so deluded. Are you kidding me? She's going to shut the door right in his face. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe she won't. I'm kind of rooting for the making love part later.
Yeah, I'm with you. That's great. So I want to ask you a little bit about the third story, The Bartender. Again, it deals with the theme of infidelity. The protagonist is Robert. He's a bit of a chronic philanderer. He finally finds love and the goodness of a new wife, Althea. She gets pregnant, but he can't stay loyal. He has an affair. But again, I found myself not liking what he does, but feeling sort of tender about him. I don't know why.
I'm so glad to hear that. You know,
what's your view?
Well, the truth is, I think he's a scoundrel and he's not likable at all, but he's lovable. You know, and I look at characters that way. The way you look at your drunk uncle who's done a little time.
Yeah.
You know, he's really interesting. You don't really like him. He's rude and talks too much and drinks too much at Thanksgiving, but you really love your Uncle Harry. I think with Robert, he seemed to embody this. Well, Freud. Let's talk about Sigmund Freud, right? So Freud talked about
Eros. It always comes back to Freud.
Eros, right? Eros is life force. He said, but in all of us, there's not only erotic energy, which is life energy, the kind that creates and goes to work and does good things. There's also thanatos, the death instinct, that walking hand in hand with our erotic life force, positive, creative energy is this death energy. To me, Robert in The Bartender has just got a good, healthy dose of that oblivion, of that oblivion-seeking part of him. And I frankly see it in us all. I know it's in me. I know that I can have a certain amount of panic when things go too well. And, you know, I try not to sabotage things, but he's really got it.
What's the problem? I'm curious when you write these stories, if you know who these guys are and where they're taking you, or do you learn
It's the opposite. And I'll tell you, man, whenever I've had too much foreknowledge, it's because I'm contriving it, and it's always wooden and false.
So interesting.
It really feels like things might be working when I have no control at all, and I'm not even writing about people I want to write about.
Then
something real might happen.
It's so interesting. Well, it sure feels real. You know, the last time we talked, it was about your wonderful memoir, Townie, and you said something about your father that has really stuck with me. Because in describing your childhood, if one reads the memoir, I think people could be forgiven from thinking that your father... It must have been tough on you kids because of some choices that your father made. And I asked you about that, and you just said, you know, he was the best person that he knew how to be.
Yeah.
Which was just an extraordinarily compassionate statement, and it's what I feel in these characters.
Well, thank you.
So it's really hard to kind of focus on the flaws and say, boy, did he really screw things up, and why did he decide to do that, and he should have done that, and why was he unfaithful, and it's all bad stuff. But it's like... They're trying.
Yeah, you know, and thank you for saying that. You know, I heard a rock and roller say, I think it was George Thorogood. Someone asked him, hey, Mr. Thorogood, why do you play the kind of rock and roll you do? He said, because I grew up listening to garage rock and roll, and I like to play what I like. So I'm bringing this up because I'm a sucker as a reader for that kind of fiction that does not judge its characters, that does not lampoon them or parody them or use them to make points. I actually find it to be unethical and really off-putting. I do think the job of the writer, as Hemingway said, is not to judge, but to seek to understand. And in that seeking, you know, there may be forgiveness. I'll tell you what, I haven't met a person yet who doesn't screw up daily. May our screw-ups be small. Yeah, I do think my father did the best he knew how, which is not the best he could have done, which is the same for me.
Yeah.
As a father and a husband, I'm trying to do the best I know how to do, given all the tangled web of forces that have made me me in the last 54 years. But I know I can do better.
Hmm. Well, André Debus III lives in Newburyport. His latest book is a collection of novellas called Dirty Love. And André, thanks so much for coming in, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Well, that's it for this holiday. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a Merry Christmas. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.